Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by Clean Cut Meals. Clean Cut Meals offer a professional meal prep service and have various plans to suit all different needs and levels of fitness. Whether you're starting your fitness journey, prepping for a show or a shoot, or play high level sport, Clean Cut Meals are freaking awesome. I use them for the entire preparation from Marathon to Sabla last April and have been using them ever since. They're just absolutely killer for saving time. Their food is awesome and tasty. I've completely gone off script, but I love the service they provide, and there's someone I'm going to be using for a long time in the future. The guys deliver nationally, so no matter where you are in the country, they can deliver. If you want to get on board and spend the time that you save shopping, prepping, cooking, and cleaning on the other things that you love, just visit www.cleancutmeals.ie to make an order, or if you have any questions, drop the guys an email, info@cleancutmeals.ie. I'm pretty sure that is on the website, cleancutmeals.ie as well, so you can just put them into Google, search them. The links are on my social medias. The guys are absolutely awesome. Also, you can use the code BKF at the checkout to get 20% off your first order. Definitely recommend checking them out, guys. Not too many meal prep services that I can recommend and put my name to, so cannot recommend Clean Cut Meals enough. So BKF at the checkout, 20% off your first order. Regardless, go check them out on www.cleancutmeals.ie. And now ready for today's episode. I hope you enjoy it.
You're listening to the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast, where Irish fitness entrepreneur Brian Keane answers your questions and interviews leaders in the world of fitness, health, mindset, and natural wellness. Come join the fun.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast. We talk everything fitness, nutrition, and mindset to help you with your goals. Today's episode is a Q&A where I've pooled questions from my Instagram, Brian Keane Fitness, Brian_Keane_fitness. So a range of different topics that I'm going to cover today. Hopefully you can all hear me okay. I've got a new mic for the last couple of episodes and I'm still recording from my living room. So hopefully everyone can hear me okay. I know there was one or two echoey episodes as I made the transition in my new house, and I do plan to put a studio in this place where I'll be recording podcasts, but hopefully you can all hear me perfectly now. And I think we've got the sound more or less down. Also a massive thank you to everybody who's been leaving reviews on iTunes. I've been putting a bit of a call to action at the end of the podcast for people to leave a review if you found value. So a massive thank you if you've done that. And if you haven't done that, please do that after this episode. And we'll get straight into the Q&A. So first question comes in from scommons12. Any tips on how to recover from a hangover after a 2-day stag? So as opposed to directly answering this, I'm going to talk about kind of tips for a hangover. Just because I'm working with people in my programs at the minute, my BKF online program, my GA Lean Body program, and I have a lot of people, because of the way summer falls, there's a lot of events, a lot of festivals, a lot of weddings or different dates that people are going on, where there's normally either one night out or two nights back to back. And there's a couple of things I do with people in my programs that I'm going to share here in the hopes that they help, one, improve your recovery from a hangover, and two, your minimization of any damage that you would be doing from, say, alcohol in terms of your body composition goals. So building muscle, your performance, fat loss, etc. So the first thing to understand with alcohol, and I spoke about this in the fitness mindset in my book, in the alcohol section, that I have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with alcohol in the sense of body composition. One reason that I love it is that alcohol is a usable energy source. Your body will use it as an energy source. Now, it's a really poor energy source. It's like trying to run your car on water, but it will work temporarily. And your body will basically use alcohol for its immediate fuel source. So I'm going to break this down into very, very basic. There's a lot of metabolic factors, genetic factors, and just absorption and digestibility factors that come into play. But in its most basic form, the way our body uses energy is we use glucose first, so the carbohydrates that you've eaten that day, glycogen, muscle glycogen, which is carbohydrates you've eaten over the last couple of days, and then your fat stores. What happens with alcohol is it jumps to the front of the queue. So it becomes the usable energy source. It's why if you've ever gone to the gym or gone for a run or done a workout the day after a night out, you feel like you're sweating the alcohol out of your system. It's because your body's using it as an energy source. So that's why I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with it, because you can burn through it pretty quickly. Even though you'll feel like crap during your run or during your workout, you can burn through it. The reason I hate it is that one, it works as a displacing agent for nutrients. So any nutrients that you take around the time of alcohol, a lot of them don't get absorbed. It works as a displacing agent. So if you picture a bouncer at the door of a nightclub and they're turning people away, that's kind of what alcohol does with vitamins and minerals. It works as a displacing agent. It basically just turns them away. That aspect of it means that you're probably going to be deficient in a lot of vitamins and minerals for a day or two while your body's detoxifying itself from alcohol. So one of the ways to hack this is to make sure that you don't let your nutrition slide even though you've got a hangover. And the people that I work with in my programs, and again, everybody has different systems that they use, different coaches, different trainers, different people, different, if you've designed your own strategies, people have different systems that they use that work for them. But generally, using a little bit of evidence-based, using a little bit of anecdotal experience, generally what works quite well for people is it's not understanding that it's not the alcohol itself that sets you back in terms of body composition. It's what happens around the alcohol. It's the losing of inhibitions, and we've all made bad fucking decisions when we've had too much to drink, but particularly around the area of food, that it's very hard to say no to that pizza or that takeaway that night if you've had 10 drinks. It's that's going to set you back. The trans fatty acids, the overeating of calories. There was a great episode on the podcast with Becca Gillen where she was speaking about banking her calories for the weekend. And the thing that she does herself and does with her clients, that she banks the calories. And then if they want to go out at the weekend, they have lower calories during the week. And then they use their alcohol calories at the weekend, which is an effective strategy for a lot of people, particularly if you're going out every single weekend. And that works quite well. Where understanding that it's not the calories itself that set you back. Now, by all means, they're definitely not the best calories you can consume, but it's everything else around alcohol that tends to affect people negatively in terms of body composition. It's the pizza that night. It's the hangover the next day where you're eating ice cream and crappy food all day because your energy levels are low. You haven't slept well, so your insulin sensitivity is all out of whack. You're way more insulin resistant, meaning that your body doesn't absorb the carbohydrates as much and you've got pretty bad cravings. When you have alcohol in your system, particularly if you're drinking at nighttime, it disrupts your REM sleep, which is your rapid eye movement sleep. It's your deep restorative sleep, and alcohol basically stops you dropping into deep REM sleep. And there's a big misconception that people take a nightcap or they're like, oh yeah, well I'll conk out after I have, you know, 5 or 6 drinks. That's not sleep as such, or high quality sleep. You're unconscious, yes, but you're not dropping into deep restorative sleep. It's why you're so tired the next day. So that's a bit of a misconception that is worth understanding, that 5 or 6 drinks that knock you out at night, yes, they'll knock you unconscious, but you're not going to get the benefit of sleep, and it's probably why you're so tired the following day. So that can lead itself to a whole host of other problems in terms of willpowers tend to be lower after you haven't had a good night's sleep. So if your willpower is lower, you're less likely to stay on your nutritional strategy or stay on your diet or make good food choices. If you haven't dropped into good deep REM sleep, your insulin resistance is going to be a bit worse, so you're not going to absorb carbohydrates as efficiently, or you're going to be craving sugary foods or crappier sources of food. And these are the issues with alcohol that can set you back, because 5 or 6 gin and tonics or 5 or 6 pints of Heineken have now become 5 or 6 pints of Heineken or 5 or 6 gin and tonics with a pizza that night or a takeaway, and then 2 tubs of Ben and Jerry's the next day, a Sunday roast, a deep fried takeaway Chinese in the evening, and then back on track on Monday. That's what sets you back. So if you can get that under control, that you can definitely factor in your alcohol. I've got people that come through my programs that drink every weekend, and we just factor it in. One of the things that works, and again, this varies person to person, so I'm going to have a little bit of creative leeway on this one because there is no one size fits all, but this does tend to work for 90% of people when body composition is the goal, is I like to drop carbohydrates on So if you're going out on a Saturday night, I like to drop carbohydrates that day. Keep fats high so that you don't get drunk too quickly when you're out. So your calories don't necessarily drop that low, but you keep your protein high, you keep your veg in there, you keep your fats, and you drop back your carbohydrates. And then you use your free meal that week for your alcohol calories. And then the following day, you get back on with your nutritional plan. You have a good quality breakfast. You possibly train that day, and then you make good food choices throughout the day. That tends to work quite well. I try to piggyback that with doing your hard workout the day before or the day of the night out. This is a little bit of a catch-22 because you're not going to get that full recovery from the workout as your body detoxifies itself from alcohol and your muscular system is going to be a lot sore. Your muscles will be sore the following day. But in terms of output and tearing fibers down and elevating your heart rate or elevating your metabolism, that hardest workout the night before a night or that day before a night out can mentally make you feel better about actually having those alcohol calories and feeling better on the night out. And it can also give you that little bit of a metabolic boost where you're burning more calories trying to repair from the workout. So personally, I like that as a strategy as well. And then the following day, personally, again, I like going for a fasted run. So if I've had 6 or 7 glasses of wine or 6 or 7 vodkas, I'll try and go for a fasted run in the morning. Even if it's only 20 minutes, it just sweats out some of that alcohol, brings it back up to the front of the queue, and I find myself anecdotally and personally that I make better food choices having done a quick workout in the morning, either a bodyweight hit or a run. I tend to have a good first meal, and then once you own the morning, you own the rest of the day, and it doesn't open up a floodgates of bad food choices just because you fell off at breakfast, which can spiral into falling off for the whole day. So that's what I would advise there in terms of body composition goals. In terms of recovering from a hangover, and this goes for a 1 or 2 day, it's relative. The only difference is that your 2 day hangover tends to be a bit worse because obviously you're consuming more alcohol. I'm a big fan of milk thistle, which is a herb that detoxifies your liver. The reason you tend to be so hungover is for a couple of reasons, really. One, you're dehydrated because alcohol is dehydrating your body effectively. So staying on top of your water can help a lot, particularly if you're someone that gets headaches from being hungover. That's normally a sign of dehydration. So having water before bed, even if it's just 0.5 liter or 1 liter before bed, and then sinking it first thing in the morning and then sipping on water all throughout the day can help you stay hydrated or get hydrated again. So that's the first thing I would look at. Milk thistle is the other thing on getting your liver back working correctly and getting itself to detoxify itself. The faster you detoxify the alcohol from your system, the better you'll feel. So that's one I like to add in. Again, use the recommended dose depending on where you pick it up. Holland & Barrett or Evergreen or any health store will have that. And what I like to do then is I like to load up on broccoli and cauliflower the following day. Now, it sounds like a funny one, but they tend to be very well processed and absorbed and work well for the liver in terms of vegetables and the vitamins and minerals that are in those foods. So I try and incorporate those in my dinner or at least twice that day, lunch and dinner, just because I always, even if that placebo effect of, right, I'm detoxifying my liver, I'm going to feel better, I'm making healthier food choices around that, it tends to cure the hangover faster. So that's what I would advise. There's not much you can do. Everyone will have their own little versions of things that help them. But the best I can offer in terms of my own area of expertise and what I'm familiar with is how it affects body composition and how to do damage limitation on that. That I feel confident in supplying value on. After that, in terms of just feeling better from a hangover, it's getting back hydrated and getting your liver back working again. Everything else outside of that is going to be anecdotal and down to what works best for you. Some of you will find a workout clears your head. Some of you will go to a sauna or a steam room and that's what works for you. You'll have all these other strategies. Some of you will have a hair of the dog. You'll have a shot in the morning and that sets you up for the day. I've got friends that do that. So it's very much outside of that experimenting what works for you in terms of just pure hangover cleansing and feeling better from it. In terms of body composition, I would apply all of those tips and hopefully that helps. And anybody that has any events, festivals, or just regular nights out over the summer, hopefully that supports you with your body composition goals as well. Next one from Kate Welch Sham on Instagram. I would love to hear some more information on the podcast about central nervous system fatigue from caffeine. So central nervous system fatigue is something I've talked about on the podcast in the past. If you just put into iTunes or Google Brian Keane Fitness Podcast, central nervous system, it'll bring up some previous episodes where I've talked about central nervous system fatigue. This is the kind of the higher state of overtraining. So if you hear the term overtraining, in 9 out of 10 cases, people are talking about central nervous system fatigue. And you don't have to get this from training. Central nervous system fatigue comes from too much cortisol circulating in the body and just too much stress hormone. Cortisol is your stress hormone. And when there's too much cortisol circulating through your body, it can manifest itself in the figurative death by a thousand cuts. It can give you all a host of problems, from lack of sex drive to being never hungry or being always hungry, to not sleeping, to not having energy, to having terrible workouts, to being moody, etc. All of these things come from central nervous system fatigue. There's also muscular fatigue when people refer to overtraining. That's when you can't get blood into the muscle and you can't actually feel the muscle because that muscle's been overstimulated over the previous days. You'll get that if you do, you know, chest day or glutes day, glutes 4 days in a row, and you just can't feel that muscle anymore. That's normally muscular over fatigue. It's way easier to recognize. Central nervous system fatigue can show up from too much circulation of cortisol in the body, regardless of how that cortisol has been circulated or where it came from. That can come from too much training, from overtraining for, you know, training twice a day in the gym or training for an Ironman or training for marathons, etc. You can get central nervous system fatigue from that. You can get central nervous system fatigue from too much adrenaline coming through your body through stress at work or from not sleeping. That can also cause it. Or it can come from caffeine, where you're overstimulated and getting central nervous system fatigue. I have some personal experience with central nervous system fatigue from caffeine, and with some clients that I've worked with. So I'm going to share my own experience with this in the hopes that it helps, and making you understand that caffeine is an amazing thing to include into your regimen if you're caffeine tolerant and it works for you. If performance is your goal, improving performance, or fat loss is your goal, it can increase lipolysis, which releases fatty acids from the cells so you can burn it for fuel, and it can improve just cognitive enhancement and ability in general. So if you have any tasks that require a lot of thinking, caffeine can support that. But it's the dangers in the dose for a lot of people. When I used to compete as a bodybuilder and a competitive fitness model, I used to fly around the world doing different photo shoots, doing different shows, and my intake of caffeine was ludicrously high, because I was taking fat burners during that time in my life. So I was trying to stay lean. I was taking pre-workouts, and then I was drinking coffee on top of that. And central nervous system fatigue from caffeine, for me, it showed up in a disruption in sleep first. So what I noticed was I was so tired all the time, cognitively, mentally, and physically, and I would lie down and I just couldn't sleep. Or else I would fall asleep and I would wake up 3 or 4 times in the middle of the night and couldn't go back to sleep. That's normally a sign of central nervous system fatigue, and particularly from caffeine. Understanding that caffeine has a between an 8 and 10 hour half-life, which means that after between 4 and 5 hours later, there's still half of that caffeine circulating in your system. So if you drank a cup of coffee that is 200 micrograms of caffeine, there's 100 micrograms of caffeine in your system 4 to 5 hours later. That's why cutting it before bed. I generally go to bed around 9 p.m. most days during the week, because I get up at 4 or 5. And when I go to bed at 9 p.m., I never have caffeine after 12 p.m., for example, because I want it out of my system by the time I'm dropping into sleep or I'm going to bed or going to sleep. So that is one that I didn't do when I was traveling the world at that stage. I was consuming a lot of caffeine, so I wasn't sleeping. The next thing then is your sex drive tends to plummet. And this happens with both genders. For me, it was a case that it wasn't that I couldn't have sex, it's just that I didn't want it. So I physically could, I just had no interest. And as someone that has quite a healthy sex drive anyway, being a bit of an understatement, is that for me was a sign that, right, something's not up, pardon the pun, that, or something's up in terms of that my body's starting to shut down slightly, so I need to look at this. So that's how it showed up for me. For some guys, it shows up that they physically can't. They literally, they completely from overstimulation. And there's a, I spoke about this in a previous podcast, from too much pre-workouts. It's called Stimdic, where there's an overstimulation of cortisol in the body, or else there's an overstimulation of blood flow elsewhere in the body, and you're not able to get an erection as a result from too much stimulants. That's a common thing with guys that take a lot of stimulants as well. Smokers and coffee drinkers, and people that drink 5 or 6 cans of Red Bull or Monster a day, that can be an issue with them as well. So if that's you and you have any erectile dysfunction issues from that, that may be worth considering cutting back on or minimizing, and see if that fixes the problem. But for me, it was that. And then last was, I couldn't get full anytime I ate. So I would eat and eat and eat and eat and eat, and I was never able to get full. So that was full-blown central nervous system fatigue for me. It was a combination of overtraining and a combination of over-caffeination and stimulation for me. So what I would advise for anyone that's worried about central nervous system fatigue, particularly from caffeine, ask, have you got any of those symptoms? Again, the order in which they show up is varies person to person. I get some people that come and it's a sex drive that goes first. I get other people that come and they can't get hungry, they can't get full or satiated from food, or else they're never hungry. That can happen as well, where there's too much cortisol and you're just never hungry. So that's normally the signs of central nervous system fatigue. In terms of cutting back, what I did was I weaned back. So you could probably go cold turkey on it. I'm not 100% sure on the medical dangers of cutting caffeine directly. I know there's certain things that you can't cut directly. For example, alcohol, people that are alcoholics, you can't go cold turkey because some people can die from that. Things like heroin, opiate drugs, you can, and it'll just be a horrible process of detoxing, but you won't actually die from detoxing. Caffeine, I'm not sure if you're taking a ridiculous amount of caffeine and you go to zero, I would imagine your body would just crash, but I don't have any medical studies to back that up, and it's not what I did. What I did was I weaned back. So first I cut out my fat burners, so I stopped taking those. I haven't taken fat burners in 4 years since I stopped competing, and I stopped taking fat burners. Then I stopped drinking coffee. And then thirdly, I cut back on the pre-workouts until I was back to just green tea. And then everything started to come back right again. I scaled back my training. My training was crap for about 6 weeks because I had no energy and I was just really lethargic all the time. But after about 6 weeks, my adrenals, your adrenal glands started to kind of come back right, working again. Sleep started to improve, so I was getting energy from that. My satiation with the hunger felt way better, so I wasn't overeating food, and then my training started to improve, and then I gradually reintroduced small amounts of caffeine. Now I have a daily limit. So I spoke on a previous podcast on the life experiments, the hacks that I use daily, that I try and give up 2 days a week every week with zero caffeine, sometimes 3 days a week, so that I can get all the cognitive enhancing abilities or the performance enhancing abilities that it provides. And on a daily, I'll take possibly a pre-workout. I use the Flexi Fury pre-workout or the Clean pre-workout, which is an organic one. It tastes disgusting, but the ingredients are super clean. And I use either of those. And then I'll have a cup of coffee if I'm doing a creative task during the day. So for example, I have a cup of coffee beside me now because I'm recording this podcast, and that's my limit for the day. I won't exceed that. And I very rarely go over that because I get very, very bad anxiety and very bad jitters when I go too high on caffeine. So, and it also affects my sleep in a negative way. So I tend to limit it. At some stage, I'll probably cut back pre-workouts completely and just go with a cup of coffee. But for now, while I'm doing a lot more glycolic work before I start building in the periodization of Ironman training, where I'll be using mostly fat-based, I'll probably be minimizing my caffeine around that time as well. So that's just something to keep an eye out for, in terms of if you're feeling overstimulated from your central nervous system from too much stimulants. And caffeine comes from coffee. It might be from Red Bull or Monster or whatever stimulated drink you're getting, or from sachets that you're consuming, or pre-workouts or fat burners. There's caffeine and a lot of different things, so just be mindful of it. Everyone's tolerance is different. Some people have a very low tolerance, some people have a very high tolerance. So find what works for you. And with caffeine, understand the dangers in the dose, and I would always try and use the minimum effective dose. So find where your sweet spot is and then stick around that, and then don't become too caffeine dependent or caffeine tolerant, which is basically that the first time you drank a cup of coffee or had a stimulated drink, you probably felt like you were on a rocket to the moon, whereas now you drink that in the morning and it just wakes you up. That's building up a tolerance. That's one of the reasons that I cut it twice a week, so that I keep that tolerance, and it gives me that benefit without having to increase my dose. So hopefully that helps. And if you have issues with that, hopefully that supports you moving forward. Next question from Chris Moo 27. Thoughts on taking a pre-workout for an evening session? Will it keep me up all night? So I wanted to pair these questions back to back just because I've spoken on caffeine and it's very, very relevant to what I've just spoken about. So I can kind of piggyback on it for this question. I'm personally not a fan of pre-workouts or caffeinated drinks or pre-workouts in general for evening sessions. For clients and for myself, when I'm working with people, one of the things that I try and get across, and you've heard me speak about this in the podcast, is that recovery is key. What we do in the gym and what we do in workouts is basically just tearing fibers down, and then we repair through our nutrition and we repair through our sleep. And I would go as far to say that nutrition is the foundation pillar, and it's not training isn't next in line. I would go as far to say that sleep is next in line, and then training is on top of that. And what happens when you get your session in and you're circulating cortisol through your body, which is what happens with caffeine, you get caffeine and it releases cortisol, which gives you a little bit of a spike and gives you focus, gives you cognitive enhancement, and basically just switches your body and brain on. And when you do that in the evening, because of the half-life of caffeine, which I spoke about earlier, that 8 to 10 hour full, that 5 to 6 hour half-life, so there's half of that caffeine in your system 5 or 6 hours later, that's going to be circulating in your system when you're trying to go to sleep. So it's going to be very disruptive on your body's ability to drop into REM, rapid eye movement sleep, which is your deep restorative sleep, as I mentioned earlier. So you're losing out. It's robbing Peter to pay Paul. You're getting your training session in and you might be getting a few extra reps or a few extra sets by taking a pre-workout, but you're losing it on the back end of not sleeping. So personally, I never use a pre-workout or any caffeine after a certain time. I'm actually not even a huge fan of training in the evenings too close to bed, because when you train, you have a controlled release of cortisol, that stress hormone, and that's a great thing to have. Cortisol is one of those hormones that we should be very thankful we have, because that release of cortisol is what circulates your body that allowed you to run away from a saber-toothed tiger 2,000 years ago. It's an evolutionary biological adaption, and it's a very, very good thing to have. And in short bursts, cortisol is very good for us. So controlled cortisol, controlled exercise. Where cortisol affects us negatively is when it's circulating in your body for too long or there's too much of it. And that's the figurative death by 1,000 cuts. So that's kind of just a little bit of an understanding on cortisol, and training releases that. So I find that if I train too close to bedtime, because training always has and always does give me a second wind of energy, it's why I split it through the day. And for years, when I used to work as a teacher during the day and a personal trainer at nighttime, I used to train in between those 2 hours because it gave me a second wind every single time. And training too close to bedtime can disrupt your sleep in the same way, because it gives you that second wind. Taking a pre-workout will definitely do that. So again, everyone responds differently. You may find that it's not affecting your sleep at all. And if you're able to take a pre-workout at 6 or 7 p.m. and go to sleep at 9, 10 or 11 p.m. and you're dropping off to sleep, no problem. You're dropping into deep sleep and you feel recovered and fresh the next day, then you may not have an issue with it. Some people have a genetic capability to detoxify themselves from caffeine much faster than others. So you may be in that demographic of people. So experiment with it by all means, but I tend to work majority rules on a lot of answers that I give, and the majority of people won't find the benefit outweighs the negative from taking a pre-workout for a few extra reps and a little bit of extra weight on your reps, so, and at the cost of a night's sleep. So personal experience, I wouldn't even consider it. It wouldn't even be an option. I try and go to bed, as I said, around 9 10 p.m. the latest during the week, and I'll never take caffeine after 12 p.m. for that reason, so that it's out of my system. So I would experiment with it by all means, try it, but I would imagine there's a high chance that it'll keep you up that night and you won't do it again. But again, depends on your caffeine tolerance, depends on your genetic makeup. So experiment with it and see. But my gut reaction is I probably wouldn't. I would try and do that session without a pre-workout. Maybe use some MCT oil or some medium chain triglyceride, caprylic acid, something that gives your body a little bit of a ketone release so that you have an energy source, but it's not stimulated. That can work quite well. So maybe play around with that, or even some simple sugars depending on the workout that you're doing. I have a couple of my GEA players that do that are quite caffeine sensitive. I was speaking with one of them yesterday, so it's fresh in the top of my mind on using glucose before games because of his caffeine sensitivity. So that's something that's worth experimenting with too. But it very much depends on your workout and your overall nutrition. But they are two things that are worth looking into as well. Okay, next question. Any tips for shift workers from Cormac Kelly? So shift workers are a little bit of a tricky one, and I've got a lot of experience working with people that are either nurses or work in factories or work just shift work, particularly people coming through my BKF online program. And before I offer tips, which I definitely have and that support a lot of people, the first thing that's worth understanding with shift workers is a combination of understanding what's going on with your body when you're working night shift and upsetting your circadian rhythm, and then how your nutrition is affected by that. Training is pretty straightforward. For training for shift workers, it's the same as any time. Whenever you can train, do that and then base your nutrition around that. But what happens with shift workers is we have, and I spoke about this in the sleep section of the fitness mindset in my book, and I spoke about the circadian rhythm, and we have a circadian rhythm. Now, it's slightly varied person to person, but the general circadian rhythm for most people is when the sun goes down at nighttime, that we start to produce melatonin, which is our hormone that tells you that it's time to fall asleep and starts circulating your body and makes you sleepy. And then that peaks and we fall asleep, and then morning time when the sun rises, we start to wake up naturally. That's kind of your circadian rhythm in a nutshell. That again has been slightly hacked over the last few hundred years, the invention of the light bulb, particularly now with LED blue light on our screens, all of our natural melatonin production gets disrupted. I'm writing right now it'll be a GEA ebook for my website, and I'm putting a section in there on sleep. And I spoke about my experience in the Sahara when I was doing the Marathon de Sable, the 256 kilometer self-sufficient race to the Sahara, that as, and this is going to sound really weird, and in writing, even when I read it back, I'm like, yeah, now that I think of it, that's crazy. I was running a marathon every day, and an ultra marathon, 86 kilometers on day 4, and I was wrecked. And normally when I'm that tired and overtrained and muscularly sore, I can't sleep. And I was sleeping outside. I was in a tent, sleeping on rocks and sand, in a sleeping bag, and it was freezing at nighttime. If you think of the contrast of the heat in the Sahara during the day, between 40 and 50 degrees, between 12 and 3, it was the opposite end of the spectrum at nighttime. It was freezing. And I slept better than I've ever slept. But it was the first time ever in my life that there was no digital devices, there was nothing there. But it would get dark in the Sahara around 8 p.m. I would fall asleep about 8:30, and then the sunrise would come up about 5 a.m. And then you were awake by 5:15. And it was the best I've ever slept in my entire life, in the weirdest way, because normally I go the complete opposite when I'm training at that level of intensity and doing, 6-7 hours of training a day. And normally it goes the complete opposite. I can't sleep at all. But it shows the power of the circadian rhythm and how it's hardwired in our biology, because falling asleep when the sun goes down and waking up when the sun comes up is how we're evolved to sleep. And a lot of us that work normal jobs, it's disrupted slightly by the blue light on our phones or the lights from our light bulbs. But for shift workers, it's completely disrupted. It's thrown up in disarray nearly 180 degrees, because you're literally waking up when your body wants to sleep and you're sleeping when your body wants to be awake. It's one of the reasons that you may find it so difficult to fall asleep even after having worked all evening, because the sun is peeking in through your curtains and your body and brain just doesn't want to sleep. That's your circadian rhythm working against you. So one of the tips that I offer, and I'm going to go off in a couple of different directions with this one, because the nutrition one is pretty straightforward and I'll share that at the end. But the number one thing for shift workers to try and get right, and I've shared this with a girl in my current BKF program, that she's a nurse and she's the shift worker, changes every 2 weeks. And getting blackout blinds or getting blackout curtains and trying to mimic nighttime as much as possible during the day can give you a fighting chance in terms of getting your recovery right, so that you're able to actually fall asleep and get your deep REM sleep that you need. And then it makes your nutrition and your diet choices so much easier, because you're not working against those insulin sensitivity issues or insulin resistance issues. One of the reasons I wanted to answer this question on the back of the central nervous system fatigue from caffeine was because there's quite a heavy correlation in terms of the sleep that is getting disrupted and how it makes for negative food choices. I spoke about it in question one with the hangover as well, that when you're dealing with a hangover, that you're not dropping into deep REM sleep, and that's why you're not waking up feeling refreshed the following day and you're making poor food choices because of slight insulin resistance that day. That same thing happens for shift workers, because you're not dropping into deep REM sleep and getting the recovery from sleep that you need. So if you can hack that, it makes the nutrition and diet so much easier. It's why I want to talk on this first and then piggyback it off the nutrition and diet at the end. So I would look into trying to maximize your sleep during the day. So in my room, for example, in my new house, I've got blackout blinds and blackout curtains. Because I go to bed at 9 p.m. and I get up at 4:30 or 5, it's still pretty bright out now. And I try and prioritize those 7.5 hours of sleep. So I work for REM cycles. Your body drops into 90-minute REM cycles, and it takes me about 30 minutes to unwind and fall asleep. So I give myself an eight-hour window every night. And I try and black out all the light in the room so that I'm able to get that natural melatonin production and my body's able to actually fall to sleep and get to sleep. I would advise doing that as a night shift worker. You don't necessarily need both. I have both, but I'm a bit overkill because I'm a notoriously poor sleeper. And I would get blackout blinds or blackout curtains. And I would make sure that you are in a dark room when you come home and you're actually set to sleep during the day. That's number one. Number two, I would try and keep a routine as close to what you do when you're not working shifts as possible. So, for example, habits are very, very important in terms of signaling to our brain what we're about to do. And I spoke about in the fitness mindset that we don't even think about our habits, that we ride the horse of our habits and we don't even realize what we're doing. A lot of us will put on our shoes in the morning and put on the same shoe, you know, our left one or our right one every single morning, and it's completely subconscious and we don't even realize we're doing it. Or we brush our teeth and we're listening to a podcast, or we've made our breakfast and we're at work before we even realize it. Or when you start driving somewhere on a Saturday and you end up driving to work because you're on autopilot, you're on using your habits to dictate your what's going on. Again, it's an evolutionary trait on cognitive ease and making sure that we have the past at least resistance so that we can focus on things that are important and keep us alive. It's a survival evolutionary adaption. And having those habits and cues that you use when you're not working shifts can help you as a shift worker. So for example, if you're used to brushing your teeth, watching 20 minutes of a Netflix show and then going to sleep, and that's what you do when you're not working night shift, I would mimic that on the weeks that you're working night shift as well. So that you brush your teeth, you have, you know, blue light blocking glasses if you're using your phone screen, and you're watching your 20 minutes show, and then you're in a blackout room and then you fall asleep. So you mimic it and you signal to your brain that this is what you're doing. It's time for bed. It's time for sleep. On the back of that, then, it's mimicking what you do during the day, but just flipping the times for nighttime. This is probably the biggest tip that I can offer shift workers, because what happens with some shift workers is they think they need to live two different lives, what they do when they're working day shift and what they do when they're working night shift. I would advise completely flipping that and mimicking everything you do during the day and then shifting it into the night shift. So for example, if you normally have breakfast at 7 a.m. during the week when you're working day shift, you switch to 7 p.m. at nighttime, and then you have 7 p.m., then 3 hours later you have a snack, 3 hours later you have a lunch, even though it might be, you know, 12 or 1 a.m. in the morning. And then you have your workout, you come home, you brush your teeth, you watch your Netflix, and you go to bed. You literally mimic it. So whatever your goals are with your training and nutrition, the fact that you work shift work is irrelevant. Your training program and your nutrition plan should always be in alignment with whatever it is that you're trying to achieve and working towards your goals. Once you're doing that, it's about mimicking the things that support that and just flipping the time of day so that your breakfast is at 7 p.m. as opposed to 7 a.m., which is what the majority of people would have. So that's what I would advise on a shift worker. But I would prioritize getting your sleep right first, because of all the benefits of deep restorative REM sleep, all the effects that it has on your body's ability to process carbohydrates, regulate hunger, make sure that your energy levels are staying okay, things that I talked about in question one and two. Hopefully that will help, and that's what I would advise. And again, regardless of what your goals are, work backwards from it. Your nutrition, your training should all be in alignment with your goals. You're just making those tweaks on top of it. The last thing that I'll offer that just came to mind is something that I've added in for a girl recently, and I've done this with several people in the past with high levels of success, and that's supplementing back in melatonin, which is that supplement that you produce naturally at nighttime anyways. That gets completely downregulated and doesn't produce that effectively for people that work shifts. So what I would probably advise considering is getting your hands and you need to get it shipped in from the US and from Canada. It's a little bit tricky of a supplement to get just for regulation in the EU. But again, perfectly healthy as long as you don't have any pre-existing issues or genetic disorders in terms of melatonin production. And taking a small amount of that, again, doses dependent on the person, dependent on body weight, but taking that on the weeks you're working night shift, purely because the reason supplements work so well for people, and even though there are certain scientifically backed ones that work for the majority of people and the majority rule applies with creatine and whey protein and branched chain amino acids, etc., the way supplements really come into their own is when they supplement what you're missing in your diet or supplement what you're missing in your lifestyle. This is a key where supplements can come in great for shift workers, because you're not going to be naturally producing that melatonin because your circadian rhythm is going to be disrupted from working nights. So you can supplement it back in so that you get the natural levels in your body. So that's the last thing I would look into there. And hopefully that helps for any shift workers listening. Next one comes in from Unibob. Is it possible to maintain a six pack all year? Okay, this is going to be quite a quick one. Yes, 100%. Again, this is the case where six pack is very relative to each person, and that sounds obvious, but when your levels of body fat are low enough, or people that are just genetically very skinny, a lot of people will have six packs. Most people have six packs anyway. It's just that they're covered from layers of fat. It's why you can't see it. And it's very easy to hold. I won't say it's very easy to hold a six pack, but very, very possible to maintain it. Particularly if what got you the six pack in the first place was very sustainable long term. So for example, the analogy I like to use for getting a six pack is like pushing a tire up a hill. It takes a lot of work to push a tire up a hill, but once you get it to the top, it's actually relatively easy to maintain it, because you've found strategies nutritionally and training wise that work for your body, that allow you to get to that level of body fat and that level of muscle definition that allows you to hold that six pack. So when I work with people in my programs, I have a big philosophy on teach a man or a woman to fish and they'll eat for a lifetime. Give them a fish and they'll eat for a day. What happens with getting a six pack? If you get a six pack through over dieting, through twice a day training, through going into a massive deficit, through using fat burners, yes, it's going to be very difficult to maintain that all year, because what got you there, the process of what got you there, isn't really sustainable long term, because you can't work out 4 hours a day in a calorie deficit and take fat burners all year round and your body to respond in the way that it did initially. However, if you did it where you dropped into a deficit, you use a good quality training program, you were possibly cycling your carbohydrates so you could do something long term and sustainable long term nutritionally, and your body fat gradually dropped and you had a six pack,
that's super easy to maintain, because what got you there is what keeps you there. And as long as you don't go take the piss and go crazy with your nutrition and start eating McDonald's or fast food three times a day for 6 months, you're going to be able to maintain it really, really easily. So how you get there is everything. I'm big on process, and one of my favorite quotes that I brain tattooed onto my head, onto my brain, is the Buddha quote of, if you can't be happy on the journey, how can you be happy at the destination? That's kind of how six-pack abs are. If you were miserable getting them and it took so much effort and fat burners and training and diet restrictions to get there, yes, you'll get to the destination, you'll be happy that you have the photo, and then you're probably going to go back looking the way you looked, maybe slightly less, slightly leaner than you were when you started, but you're not going to be able to maintain it long term. However, if you got there by enjoying the process and you had a nutritional strategy and a training program that allowed you to keep doing it long term, and it became the way that you lived and not a diet you were following or a training program you were just following, and you adapted it and merged it into your lifestyle, then it's super easy to maintain it all year. I've had a six pack. I'll use myself because you're your own best example. I've had a six pack for about 10 years and I've never lost it. But I keep my nutrition on point all through the year. My training stays hard and it's very, very easy to hold it. And I've got countless clients that are the same, and there'll be a lot of you listening that are similar. And as long as you stay on track of your nutrition and stay on track of the thing that brought you to the ball game in the first place, there's no reason you can't maintain it all year. Again, you may be slightly leaner at certain times. You may be slightly have a little bit more body fat over it at certain times, but you'll have a six pack or the outline of it all year round. It's not overly difficult to do, as long as what got you there in the first place and got you the six pack in the first place was something that you were able to keep and sustain long term. Next question comes in from Anonymous. I would love if sometime you did a podcast on managing work stress outside of work and switching off from work issues. Okay, so they're kind of two different questions. And one of the reasons that I wanted to answer them is that I've already spoken about cortisol earlier, and cortisol effectively is a stress hormone. So I've layered a little bit of foundation knowledge on that, hopefully, if you've listened to the podcast all the way through. And managing stress outside of work is very much relative to each person on what works for them. So there's a couple of strategies that I'm going to share and offer that I would definitely experiment with. I'll talk about ones that have worked for me, and I'll talk about ones that I've heard have worked anecdotally for other people and people that I've worked with. For me, managing stress outside of work, and I've came from that background. I used to work as a primary school teacher, so working that traditional, you know, 8 to 4 in my case, and doing that traditional lifestyle and having all the stresses that come with, particularly the English educational system, where you're working to forms and you're working to levels, and there's a lot more paperwork involved than, say, the Irish system. And managing that stress for me, I always use training and physical exertion to manage that stress. So for me, it was normally the gym, or it was a run, or it was a cycle, or I used to play a lot of 5-a-side and 7-a-side football. Or when I play Gaelic football, I used to fly over and back. When I lived in London, I would fly over and back for my club championship games. And that always worked very, very well for me, because training is a controlled stimulus, it's a controlled stressor, and all the serotonin release that you get, the happy hormones that come and the endorphins that come from training, can make you feel de-stressed nearly instantly. And a little bit of a life hack that I use is, if something's bothering me in my life and something's stressing me out, either a person, a situation, an opportunity, if something is stressing me out, I have a training rule that if it's still bothering me after I've had a hard workout, it's something I need to lean into, and it's something that I need to actually resolve. If it just dissipates after the workout, I realize I was just being stupid and I was in my own head and I was letting my monkey brain, the part of your unevolved system one part of your brain that is hasn't been hardwired, and it's just your chimp, your monkey, your Labrador, your reptilian brain, that part of your brain that is evolved through years that hasn't fully grasped the concept of not worrying about stupid stuff and is living in a kind of a primitive sense and a primitive response. That's how I make a lot of my decisions. If I'm in a relationship with somebody, or in a business meeting, or an opportunity comes my way and it's really stressing me out and I'm not sure what I'm going to do, and I go and do an incredibly hard workout in the gym, and I come out and it's still bothering me, I realize that, right, I need to put a plan in place and figure out how I'm going to resolve this issue. So what I spoke about in the fitness mindset in the stress section was sometimes it's conflict avoidance that causes that stress, that there's normally a situation at work or a person at work or a part of the workplace that's really stressing us out and that we're avoiding it, and that's the reason it's causing so much stress in that workplace. It's a person, it's a task, whatever it is. If you've trained and that's still bothering you, that's probably a sign that that's what you need to lean into and resolve and figure out. I love the Vincent van Gogh quote that the comfort zone is a beautiful place, but nothing ever grows there. And that's how work, how stress in the workplace is. That's how stress in life is in general. That when you lean into the things that are making you feel stressed, you tend to feel so much better having done that. And using that, whatever it is that allows you to detach from work. For me, it was training. For some other people, it's meditation. For some people, it's walks, listening to an audiobook or listening to music. Whatever that detachment from work is, that allows you to switch off and then allows you to give a wider angle perspective on the problems that's causing that stress, that can go a long way towards mitigating it. So that's what I would offer as someone that still uses that protocol on, if anything in my life is stressing me out and it still bothers me after a workout, I need to lean into it and figure out. I'll talk to my inner circle, or I'll get a little bit more self-aware and try and take a wider angle view on what's going on so that I can see it from different perspectives and try and fix it. But to be honest, in 99 out of 100 cases, normally it all dissipates after a hard workout for me. Switching off from work issues then is a little bit different, because it's not a case of just managing the stress outside of work. Switching off from work issues is nearly a learned skill, in my opinion, of being able to be one person in one place and another person in another place. And the term that's used in business a lot is wearing different hats depending on where you are. And the example that I'm going to use is, I'm a very, very different person when I give a speech to when I'm in the gym training, to when I'm playing with Holly and kicking football in our front lawn. I'm showing up as very, very different people in those situations. And switching off from work issues is a learned skill on knowing that when you take work home with you and taking that stress home with you, it's making you worse in the area of your life that may be important outside of work. So if you're taking that stress of work into the gym, it's probably giving you a subpar workout in some cases. If you're taking that stress of work home to your family or to your kids or to your boyfriend or girlfriend, it's making you a worse partner or a worse father or mother, because you can't switch off and you're constantly in your own head about what went on during that day. I spoke in the podcast in the past that I've had a really bad habit of, when I was working, I'd be thinking and guilty about not spending time with my daughter. And then when I was spending time with my daughter, I'd be thinking about all the work that I wasn't doing. And it was this constant tug on both sides. And I felt like I was just living in this state of anxiety constantly. And it made me realize that, do you know what? It's about the deep work and being present when you're there. And that's learned. For me, some people do it more naturally than others. For me, it was learned that when I'm working, I'm working. So I'm doing deep work. So right now I'm recording this podcast. My phone is turned face down. The sound is off. It's on Do Not Disturb. I actually don't turn my phone off Do Not Disturb ever, unless I'm expecting a call, because of the scientific studies that I've read and seen on the cognitive strain of switching from task to task and actually getting back on task, that I actually never turn my phone off Do Not Disturb. So unless I'm expecting a call. But right now my phone is face down. I have my laptop in front of me with my questions, and there's nothing else in my immediate surroundings. So I'm trying to continuously be fully present while I'm recording this podcast, because this is what I'm doing. It's deep work now. I'm not recording this and scrolling through Instagram. I'm not recording this and texting somebody back. I'm trying to be productive in my time on what I'm doing right now. When you do that in your workplace, it gives you the freedom to disconnect when you're outside of it. So what I would ask yourself as well, and I love the Richard Feynman quote, to not fool yourself and you're the easiest person to fool. Are you switching off and stressed out from work and not being able to switch off from work issues because you haven't done the most important task that you really needed to do. Because if that's the answer, that's about being productive being versus being busy. A lot of people, and I had this misconception for ages and a story I told myself that I would be busy and I'd be running from this person to that person doing this and I'd be busy and running around, and anytime anyone would ask me, oh, you know, can you do this or that, I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm too busy, not realizing that I wasn't being productive. I would go through the whole day and I felt like I was chewing things off all day and putting out fires, and then the end of the day would come and I'm like, I fucking produced nothing, I haven't done anything. And I'd wonder where the day went, and it made me question the difference between being productive versus being busy. And not being able to switch off from work issues for me was highly correlated with the fact that I wasn't being as productive as I could be during those work hours. So now I do what's called deep work, where I'll do a 4-hour task in the morning broken up into normally 2 or 3 chunks, where I'll take a break and walk around for 10 minutes and I'll do my most important tasks and get those done. It's the Brian Tracy or Mark Twain equivalent of eat the frog. So if you eat a frog first thing in the morning and get it done, the whole day is going to be better from there on. So I do all my creative work or eat the frog work, the work that I don't necessarily love doing, like anything to do with PDFs and uploads and anything to do with tech, I don't really like doing. But what I haven't outsourced, I do myself, and I do those first thing in the morning so that they're done. And there's a great book by Gary Kelleher called The One Thing, and it speaks about that. Really, in the workplace and in life in general, there's normally only one thing each day that we really need to do that would make everything else feel less stressful or would make everything else obsolete. And when you can identify that one thing and you get that done in the workplace, it generally allows you to disconnect when you do come home. And for me, I have my one thing every single day. So on my notepad here beside me, I've got my one thing for today is to record 2 podcasts. And my one thing is to get those done. And then everything else that's on my would like to do list, if it gets done, great. If not, I can switch off this evening and I can play with my daughter. And it doesn't matter because I've got my most important task done. So that strategy works quite well for me. So it may be worth experimenting with something along those lines and getting serious and real with yourself and asking, is the reason you can't switch off from work issues because you're not really doing what you need to do? Because when you do what you really needed to do, there's no reason for you to continue thinking about it because it's actually making you a worse employee because you need to be able to switch off. So I would offer that, and then I would combine that with training or meditation or going for a long walk, listening to music, whatever it is that switches your brain off. And combining those things can make you significantly less stressful in the workplace. That's something that's worked for me. So from a little bit of anecdotal experience, hopefully that supports you and anybody else that is struggling with switching off from work issues or switching off from work stress. And again, if you have anyone else that has other issues or any tips or tricks that they use, be sure to head over to Instagram and I'll be putting up a post on my wall that links this podcast. Just comment what you do to minimize stress underneath if you have any other tips or tricks, or hit me up on DM and let me know. So hopefully that supports you. And that is everything from today's podcast. So a little bit of a range of questions today. So a massive thank you to everybody who sent these in. Massive thank you for you listening. If you got any value from today's episode, please leave a review on iTunes and I will love you forever. Thank you for listening. Catch you all real soon.